afternoon, everyone. I'm Enid Cho, correspondent governor of the FCC, and welcome to our first event of 2013. First, may I remind everyone to switch off all your devices that ring or beep, because as you can see, we've got quite a few TV cameras here, and it may disrupt their digital signals. And also, may I remind everyone to take a look at our website for this month's exciting lineup, which includes an evening screening on January 15th of a film about Agent Orange. The filmmaker will join us here at the club. And on the 14th, we have Professor Paul O'Connor from Chinese University to talk about the Muslim community in Hong Kong. And on the 17th, we have Valianasser from Johns Hopkins University to talk about the Arab Spring. I believe we've still got a few seats left. So our speaker today needs little introduction. Mr. Justice Bukhari is often described as the most liberal of the permanent judges on the Court of Final Appeal, where he served since 1997 until he was forced to retire last year. Known as the major dissenter on the bench, he's not known to stay silent when it comes to matters of great importance to Hong Kong. And most recently, he has warned us about the gathering storm clouds over the rule of law. So it is my great honor to welcome Mr. Justice Bukhari to the club, who's here to share some of the many fascinating tales from his long and colorful career. There will be 15, 20 minutes after his talk for questions. So please welcome Mr. Justice Bukhari.
I believe that to understand the way that the law is likely to develop in the future, it is necessary to have some insight into what the legal system was in the past. This is a belief which many lawyers hold. The difference, if there's any difference between others and myself, is that I believe particularly firmly in this. Now, there's a lot that you can learn about the law simply by reading the writings which are available. But there's a lot more that it might be useful to know about the women and men who served the law in the period that you are considering. And of course, you have to bear in mind the social context, too. Therefore, I wish to talk a little bit about the way the bar was set up and the way the bench was set up in times past. One might think, therefore, that I should talk about the bar as it was when I came to it, started practicing in 1971, and then stop at the beginning of 89 and talk about the bench from that period on, since that is when I became a judge. But I would like to talk about them both more or less at the same time. It is possible to do this because barristers actually see more judges than judges do, and the other way around as well. When I came back to the bar, the situation was this. Boom times economically. The University of Hong Kong had set up a law school, but had not yet turned out its first student. The bar was less than one-tenth its present size. No barrister seriously contemplated a career in the senior judiciary. Some members of the bar had been appointed to the magistrate's court, none had been appointed to the district court, and certainly none to the high court. The first appointment to the high court from the practicing bar was 1977, when Mr. Archie Zimmern was appointed high court judge, and things did not move quickly thereafter. The next appointment to the high court bench from the bar was in 1989, and I was the appointee. A career at the bench, if it was at the bar that was successful, could lead to financial security and the satisfaction of participating in the administration of justice in one important way. And if your interest took you there, you might enter politics. But those were days of purely nominated politics, and quite a few distinguished Queen's Counsel were appointed to the Legislative Council and later to the Executive Council. The bench was staffed by the Colonial Legal Service. The judges on the bench when I came back had served in various other parts of the British Empire, Africa, British possessions in the Pacific, and the Federated Malay States. They brought with them a very large experience of the world, but although some of them were very good judges, they did not, surprisingly, refer to the cases that were decided in those jurisdictions. If you wanted to win a case on a point of law, you better find an English case on the point. That was the advice that anybody would give any other barrister coming to the bar. And if you could find even a decision of the High Court in England, that would probably be followed by the Court of Appeal in Hong Kong, although in those days it wasn't called the Court of Appeal, it was called the Full Court. The situation in Hong Kong was this. Politics were, as I said, purely nominated politics. People seemed to expect very little of government. Whatever came to them through government action or inaction, they more or less accepted it. But beneath the surface, there was considerable dissatisfaction. They didn't tend to break out into frequent demonstrations. They broke out into occasional riots. That was the situation which I came to practice law. Lawyers' law, mainly the concerns of business people, criminal law, was left to very junior people. If you were successful, you practiced commercial law, and that's the area to which I gravitated simply because the chambers in which I was in practice that kind of law. I have done about 20 homicide cases. One of them I prosecuted after I became a Queen's Counsel because there was an idea that perhaps some senior barristers should prosecute with Crown Counsel as juniors in order for Crown Counsel, if they could, learn anything from us, learn something from us. The other homicide cases I did were all done the first 5 years of my practice. It's an extraordinary situation that matters of liberty were so lowly regarded that they were relegated to very, very junior barristers. It was perhaps even more serious than it sounds. After all, the death penalty was still on the books. Although, one has to say in favor of Hong Kong that the last people to be hanged here were hanged in the same year as the last persons to be hanged in Britain. That was 1966. But it was not known whether or not the governor would automatically reprieve as he'd been doing. In those days, we spoke a rather arcane type of language in the law. At the beginning of the case, before the jury was sworn, the defendant would be addressed by the judge's clerk like this: "Prisoner at the bar, the names that you are about to hear are those of the jurors who will pass between you and our sovereign lady, the Queen, upon the several issues tried. The first time I did a homicide case, I got a jolt, because this time the clerk said, 'Prisoner at the bar, the names which you are about to hear are those of the jurors who will pass between you and our sovereign lady, the Queen, upon your life and your death.' Nobody knew whether this could possibly be serious, but everybody was quite content that a barrister of only a few years standing like myself was defending this man. Legal publications practically did not exist. But there was one thing. The bar was strongly committed to justice. A lot of the human rights which we recognize as judicially enforceable now was not thought to be judicially enforceable. Judicial review was hardly ever heard of in the courts. And yet, there were certain fundamental principles of the common law which were held in higher regard then than they seem to be held now. The right to silence is under attack now in a way which would have fallen wholly on deaf ears in the past. Double jeopardy was regarded as sacrosanct, whereas now it's gone in England and also recommended against in Hong Kong. I can see the point. You prevent the man from selling his story to the News of the World. You would have thought the demise of the News of the World would have taken care of that. So it was different, mainly because of what people felt the law could do, not because of any difference in belief of what the law can do. The sea change took place when the Bill of Rights was introduced. Now, the Bill of Rights came in this way. The Bill of Rights Ordinance abolished all the statutes of Hong Kong which were not compatible with the International Covenant on Civil Political Rights, or at least the Bill of Rights, which was more or less the International Covenant with some slight modifications. What about the future? Well, the latest patent to which the Hong Kong legislature owed its existence and powers was amended so that the Hong Kong legislature was prohibited from passing any laws which were incompatible with rights and freedoms enjoyed under the Bill of Rights. Now, previous to that, the possibility of the court striking down legislation as unconstitutional existed, but only in theory. The Hong Kong court said in 1913 in terms that if any legislation was passed incompatible with the powers in the letters patent, it would be struck down. But the powers in the letters patent allowed the governor to pass laws for the peace, order, and good government of Hong Kong. Now, this expression, peace, order, and good government, was used throughout the British Empire. And the Privy Council, first in rather arcane language and later in modern language, always made it perfectly clear that this conferred lawmaking powers in the widest possible terms. So basically, the governor could make any laws he liked. The Legislative Council and the Executive Council were advisory bodies only. The courts are hardly likely to say any law was not for the peace, order, good government of Hong Kong, unless it was an utterly absurd law, which you wouldn't expect the governor to pass in any event. Now, the Bill of Rights came under considerable attack from certain sources as we were moving towards the handover, and as the relationship between Governor Patten and the mainland authorities deteriorated, not to his discredit, in my opinion. I have no doubt that he's the greatest governor we ever had, because he has instilled in Hong Kong a belief in the rule of law and rights. But anyway, it was thought that the Bill of Rights was somehow the detrimental to orderly government. Why that is thought, I don't know, because the basic law actually, apart from enumerating many rights, in fact preserves the rights under the Bill of Rights, doing so by Article 39. So I think that if you looked at the situation simply by reading the law books, you will perceive some differences and some similarities. An appreciation of what it was really like on the ground, I think, would suggest that the differences were perhaps greater. There was no legal publication in Hong Kong in those days. Now there are so many. As I said, when I began Hong Kong's first law school, had only begun and hadn't turned out a single law student. Now there are no less than three law schools. So the situation has moved. The common law always develops. Very little of the rules of the common law remain. It is the spirit of the common law and the common law way of thinking that remained. How much of the changes in the legal system now are related to 1997? It is not very easy to say. There are many changes which would have occurred anyway. If anything, I think that as we were moving towards the handover, and it looked much more grim at the time than perhaps it looks now, people's interests in human rights and court-enforced human rights grew and grew, forged in the fires of uncertainty, and strong for that reason. I had confidence always in what would happen upon the handover. But my greatest confidence was always this, and I used to say it to people, that what you see is what you get. The courts will act independently. Nowhere in the world does the court have the purse or the sword. The political branches of government have that. The judicial branch of government has the support of the people, if they live up to that trust. And when it came to the reinterpretation I said that at least it shows that it was a straight game. Nobody can pick up the phone and tell the judges what to do. If you want to undo what we did, you have to do it openly. Now, that's the way it was. I believe that is the way it is. And I believe that it will continue that way. If it doesn't, the rule of law will die. If it continues, the rule of law will live. Taking many blows, maybe, but surviving them all. I suspect that you're more interested in asking me questions than hearing me harangue you. I am prepared to answer any of the questions you wish to ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Let's wait for the microphone.
Can you wait for the microphone?
Have one of mine, I have two.
My name is Andrew Lam. I'm one of the very few unfortunate ones to be able to get exoneration before you, Mr. Justice. And it has been very painful. But the sentiment in our profession, particularly in the criminal practicing professional, is that the quality of the judges and the inherent threat, I might say, to the judges are very serious. And we have a saying that the Court of Appeal is now being called as Court of No Appeal. You can only get justice in a Court of Final Appeal. But that is very difficult to get an entrance ticket. Now, my question is that, as I see it in reality, the appointment of the judges to, say, district court, and then uplifted from the district level to the high court, they are all ex-prosecutors. And many of those who have no experience in defending in their life, of course, that would affect their way of thinking. They would prejudge issues. Now, we have statistics showing that the conviction rate in our court, the district court,
and I asked you
is higher than in North Korea. The question is, do you see from your level as a justice in the Court of Final Appeal, and that is a very factor?
Well, you know, you always have to work hard at getting people of the right quality. And it is understandable that somebody might feel that if people have been prosecuting all their lives, they may be prosecution-minded. My experience has not been that way. One of the most fair-minded judges ever there was Gladys's father, Simon. I remember on one occasion, he was summing up to the jury. Now, he was a prosecutor all his life before he went on the bench, and he told the jury, well, actually, the laws of evidence did not permit Mr. Bukhari to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you this. So he had a very strong sense of justice. And when he was made a judge and appointed to the bench, he was given a dinner by the bar, and he said, well, some of you may think it's very difficult to win a case against the government when the judge has been working for the government all his life and advising the government. I tell you, you don't know how often we've had to advise the government they are wrong. So yes, it can happen, and perhaps some people's own experience, including yours, were not happy. But you can find a good judge just about from anywhere, and a bad one from just about anywhere as well.
Francis, I think you raised your hand.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Mr. Justice Bukhari, you had warned in the past of a gathering storm over the courts. I'm wondering whether the recent request by the Secretary for Justice to invite the Court of Final Appeal to consider asking for an interpretation from the NPCSC is what you had in mind. And do you feel that this request, what, even if the court resists it, puts the Court of Final Appeal in an invidious position?
Now, since there is actually a case before the court now, and I'm still a member of the judiciary, albeit a non-permanent judge, I would prefer not to answer the question directly, but you will be able to work it out for yourself by remembering, first of all, that I said that there were clouds on the horizon for the rule of law, that the storm which it threatened was one of unprecedented ferocity, and I expressly addressed my brothers on the Court of Final Appeal to stand up in that storm. And that if they put their faith in the people of Hong Kong, in the academy and in the profession and in the media, they will find that all these institutions will support them. So that is my indirect answer to your question, Francis.
Does that mean you're still waiting?
I'm waiting for the next question.
Do I see anyone putting up their hands for questions? It's this, that gentleman on table 5, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Ted Thomas. This is not a question, but it's something you may be pleased to hear. About an hour ago, I was gathered in another club with a group of people who've been around in Hong Kong for many, many years. And I said I was coming here to your talk. And they said, did you know his father? And I said, no, I didn't. He's one of the finest people who's ever lived. And that, I thought, was a very, very good compliment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thomas. I've always enjoyed listening to you on the radio. And you were in a film as well, weren't you, about the, you were a policeman, was involved in shooting a gorilla off what was then Connaught Center. I felt a bit sorry for the gorilla, but you had your duty to do. Yeah. Have you seen this film? It's quite good. He'll tell you about it.
I have a quick question for you, Mr. Justice. When I opened a paper today, I saw to my surprise that Alan Leung has come out saying that we can probably live with Article 23 in Hong Kong as long as we get genuine universal suffrage. So what's your view on that? Is it possible to have an Article 23 drafted in a way that makes it completely safe for Hong Kong's basic rights?
Well, I'm not exactly sure the exact words that Alan used. Maybe he was saying no more than if you gave me a choice between one or the other. And he put it that way. And maybe he was simply seeking to emphasize the importance that he attached to democracy, in which case he would be right. Some people are worried that what he says amounts to a trade-off, but Alan is a very clever and thinking man, so maybe he was just seeking to emphasize the importance that he attached to democracy. I suspect he also meant that not only would you have universal suffrage, but that you would have a legislature composed under universal suffrage, and it would be that legislature that would consider what legislation you were to enact under Article 23. And if he wished to emphasize the importance of democracy, then he was doing the right thing. After all, in Britain, for a long time, and perhaps even now, there is absolute parliamentary sovereignty. But the elected legislature is said to be a safeguard against any legislation which would be wholly unacceptable. So there it is. I have high personal regard for Alan, therefore I would like to think that he was putting his emphasis on the importance of universal suffrage. Some people are worried about it, and some of the people who have expressed their worries are also persons to whom I have respect. It'll sort it all out, but we'll see.
Right, sir.
Question and your answer. A house divided cannot stand. So what do you propose that the legal profession do to get its act in order?
In what sense do you think the house is not in order at the moment?
Well, some are for this, some are for that. There are, in effect, two major bickering groups.
Well, I'm afraid, you know, that's the nature of society, really. All you can hope is that ultimately there will be some sort of consensus, and if not consensus, then any opposition to the view that finds its way into the law will be opposition that is peaceful and as far as possible constructive. But I shouldn't think that there's anywhere in the world where you expect everybody to agree on these things. So there it is.
And the gentleman behind?
David Schlesinger, Tripod Advisors. When you look across the border, can you tell us your view of the developments of Chinese jurisprudence? Do you see that the Chinese jurisprudence is on a positive journey, or do you see no signs at all of that at all?
Well, now, the contact that I have is principally with the law students, the ones that come to Hong Kong and visit the courts, the ones that I speak to if I address some law school up in the mainland. Without exception, they are bright. They are devoted to the rule of law. And I think that it is quite possible that many of them will achieve positions of influence and abandon some of their ideals along the way. Some of them will stick to their ideals, but not manage to achieve any position of influence for whatever reason, maybe a certain inflexibility of the way they express themselves or how loudly they should express themselves or how often they should express themselves. But I have confidence that a significant proportion will be practical enough to achieve positions of influence and importance without losing their ideals. And if the future of the law in China are in those hands, they're in safe hands. We'll have to see. Remember that there was a time when almost any reference to law itself would provoke a tirade from some official source in the mainland, saying this is counter-revolutionary and an instrument for suppressing people and so the masses and so on. Now China believes in the rule of law and seems to have quite a realistic appreciation, as far as I can tell, of the problems which they face. So I am quite optimistic.
And Ching Chang has a question over there.
I'm Ching from the Singapore Straits Times. Back to the Hong Kong scene. Not long ago, our former AG has made a public statement saying that judges in Hong Kong are not familiar with the Chinese situation. And some even suggested that from now on, we should have all judges from Chinese nationality. Do you share this view? And what damage it would do to Hong Kong if such opinions were put into practice?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for Elsie, and I like him as a person. I met her not that long ago at a meeting which I chaired for one of the universities, and she was a member of the board of which I'm the chairman. And I did have to point out to her that I said something very nice about her, which was WikiLeaked. And I did say, well, Elsie, they told me, Chen, well, Yang Chao, well, come and Chao, mate. And she, and we had a nice chat about it. Now, quite honestly, you can't always agree. But I did say in an interview, I think to Margaret, that we have to give Elsie credit for this, that she said it openly so that we could react to it. I reacted to it, you reacted to it, and other people reacted to it. Now, she is a woman of some influence, I imagine, in the mainland. And if she had whispered all sorts of things into all sorts of ears, she might have done a lot of harm, particularly because we couldn't react to it. So I profoundly disagree with her. Underline profoundly and put in italics as well. But I do have to say that she deserves credit for saying it openly so that people could react to it rather than whispering into some ears. It's one of the reasons why I like her.
We have a question from Keith Brescher.
Keith Brescher, New York Times. You talked about how when you entered the profession, barristers needed to cite precedents from English courts. To what extent now, as the courts have been more willing to take precedents from other common law jurisdictions, does that risk undermining some rights in Hong Kong to the extent that some common law jurisdictions have less vigorous democracies now than the UK? For example, in areas like press laws and others, we've seen other common law jurisdictions enact even tougher legislation than the UK.
Now, the foreign judgments to which we look on matters of common law, essentially England, of course, Scotland to a certain extent, we look at the judgments of the Australian courts and the New Zealand courts for common law. When it comes to constitutional law, I myself have looked very much to the jurisprudence of the United States. Other judges on our courts also, maybe not to the same extent. We have looked to the decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. So insofar as constitutional law is concerned, the law that relates to human rights, we have tended to develop an eclectic jurisprudence, but to look at sources which in many ways are in advance in these matters of the English courts. I myself have looked to the international and transnational decisions. Human rights, actually, was articulated essentially in international tribunals before. Even a long time ago, international tribunals have talked about the rights of man. I mean, I'm afraid that's the way people used to talk about it. And maybe, to a certain extent, it was literally true. I mean, one man, one vote did mean one man, one vote. Not for women, but, you know, the world moves on. But we have looked at these tribunals. So I think that insofar as we've spread our intellectual tentacles, we have spread it towards perhaps more liberal jurisprudence. Whether it all takes is another matter, but we've looked at those sources. So I don't think that we tend to look at sources which are unacceptable. Now, of course, if you talk about legislation, it's very difficult to say. At any given time, some countries are in advance of others in some respects and behind others. I mean, take Hong Kong. When it became British possession, I suppose, theoretically, at least in 1841, although the treaty was signed later, what's the situation? In America, you had the Declaration of Independence. Marbury and Madison was established jurisprudence, the government of laws, not of men. And if you look to America for those things, and you ought to, you saw a lot. On the other hand, slavery existed. So I would have thought that you really have to look around the world and say that some jurisdictions are ahead of others in some matters and behind other jurisdictions and others. Now, the ace in the hole here is I think we have a very strong academy. Probably the greatest constitutional scholar in the world is the one that I call Hong Kong's leading constitutional scholar, Professor Yash Guy. So we tend to look at academic sources, which are very advanced as well. So we have developed an eclectic jurisprudence, but on the whole, I think one which would open the path to a more liberal and more enlightened attitude to what the law can do rather than the other way. But there are dangers, and you're quite right to point it out. You always have to look at what you're looking at with a certain amount of care.
Okay, we've got time for just one more question. I see a hand over there.
If I may recall back to the first question.
Sure.
About the choosing of judges, and also about your views about the legal system in China, where it seems that the judges were a problem, but the barristers were pretty good. What are your views on the fact that judges could be chosen by democratic process of being elected, for instance?
Well, you know, the strongest component of the American judiciary, in my opinion, is the federal judiciary. And they are not elected for office. One of the reasons is that you are enforcing certain guaranteed rights, constitutional rights, which put these beyond the immediate interests of the majority and in protection of the minority. So the judicial function really is this, that if it has any constitutional role at all, then I think either there has to be a certain ethos, or more importantly, and preferably, a document which is beyond change by the ordinary legislative process and which protects minorities and protects people who are perhaps in vulnerable positions. And an unelected judiciary is probably the best to protect it. But it is a problem. I mean, in an ideal world, yes, I think you would choose the judiciary. I mean, there are places where you don't really have a judiciary. The tribal elders who earn their place out of respect administer the law. And certainly nobody appoints them. They grow into that place. And in their own sophisticated way, they do very good justice. But on the whole, I think that we have to stay away from an elected judiciary.
Right. I think, we've covered a lot of ground here today. And I'm afraid we haven't got any time left for more questions, though I'm sure a lot of you would have other things to ask Mr. Justice Bukhari about. So please join me in thanking our guest today, and we'll see you at our next event. Thank you.
we were at the struggle all the time. No, we stopped that because we were all smiling for camera. I apologize, but yeah, we were happy.